For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini. My guest today is Elena Passarello. She is a writer and actor who's here in Spokane as part of the Gonzaga University Visiting Writers Series. She's the author of two books, 2012's Let Me Clear My Throat, and most recently, Animals Strike Curious Poses, a collection of essays which investigate and meditate on famous animals named and immortalized by humans throughout history. She's the recipient of numerous awards for her writing, including a 2015 Whiting Award, and in 2014, she was a finalist for the Oregon Book Award. She lives in Corvallis, Oregon, where she teaches at Oregon State University, and perhaps most notably to our public radio audience, she is the announcer on LiveWire with Luke Burbank from Oregon Public Broadcasting. Elena Passarello, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
So I want to start by talking about your new book, Animals Strike Curious Poses, which is, I think, really difficult for me to sort of summarize succinctly. It's a collection of essays about famous animals.
Yep.
And I read that it's loosely modeled after a medieval bestiary, a kind of encyclopedia of animals and mythic beasts.
Yeah.
But each essay is really different in form and content and sort of scope. So what was the inspiration for this book, and how did you get interested in writing about famous animals?
Well, I think I knew that I wanted to write about animals. I like animals, and I know also that a lot of other people do, so I thought maybe I could do something with that. And then I remembered how much I enjoyed writing about culture, so I was like, what about animals in culture? And that sort of slowly led me to this one kind of animal story, which is times in which humans have given an animal a name and then put it in the historical record. So when I had narrowed it down to there, I stumbled upon this idea of the medieval bestiaries, this kind of mix of like fact and imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who made them often rarely left the regions where they were writing the books, and they knew quite a bit about a lot of the animals that lived near them, but then they had to use this tremendous imagination to write the entries on, say, giraffes, or monoceron, which is what they called rhinoceroses back then.
Hmm.
I was just like, oh, that's perfect. So now I'll do animals in history that have both captured our imaginations and allowed us to view the facts of that particular species.
And I'd love to have you read a section. And I thought that since we are a classical music station as well, the Vogel Star section about Mozart's pet starling.
Yeah, so this is kind of a perfect example of fact and imagination, because we have no idea that what I'm about to read actually happened between Mozart and the starling, but I know enough about where he lived and how he composed based on reading biographies and stuff that I could kind of put the scene together. Mozart could have kept his starling's cage in the room with his billiard table, where he often composed, or it might have stood in his bedchamber, where he stayed awake with his quill and notebook. Both man and songbird were prone to singing while the rest of the house slept. No matter the living arrangements, the bird stayed with him for 36 of the most vibrant months of Mozart's career. The maestro's forte piano was constantly being shipped from his music room out to the Mellgrube for yet another subscription concert. Leopold Mozart complained in a letter that his son's home buzzed at all hours with rabble-rousing factions, students, rehearsal groups, goofy late-night jam sessions. Their noise was nonstop and deafening. Mozart reportedly hated being alone, even when he worked. And for those 3 years, work he did. The costly apartment on the Domgasse saw 60-plus compositions finished in less than 3 years. The piano concerto, as we still understand it, was built in those rooms. The Haydn quartets premiered there. The Jupiter Symphony began, and Figaro ended. And with these heavy hitters came some of the most singable ditties in the repertoire. The wafting waltz times start to the Piano Concerto No. 21, and the stately intervals of the romanza in the Serenade 13 for strings, melodies that two centuries of humans have since whistled could have first been volleyed between a genius and his Vogel Star. And you can bet your arsh that if it were an earshot, Mozart's starling junked all these immortal melodies. As Mozart hammered them shiny, the bird probably sent the tunes back upside down at half speed and double time and piped one inconsequential middle note for 5 straight seconds. It's not difficult to imagine Mozart valuing this kind of collaboration, as he spent so much of this period reaching out to various songbirds. The starling was another musician to pump ideas into Mozart's brain, like Haydn did, or Vienna's top fiddlers, or his high soprano sister-in-law with her gobsmacking range. Among the divas, the composers, and the virtuosi, the caged bird perched the furthest outside the classical box, waiting to eat all the sound it was offered and spit back strange bits with snarling gusto.
That was Elena Passarello reading from her book, Animals Strike Curious Poses. And that is a good example of, like you said, imagination and fact. But what really amazed me was the scope of this book in terms of, you know, you speak really authoritatively on music and composition, but also like horseback riding and space travel and electricity. So what was the research process like for writing this book?
I think for me, research is my creative engine. You know, there are lots of different nonfiction writers have different entrance points. Some people, memory or personal experience is really important for them. And other writers, like maybe David Foster Wallace, are intensely opinionated and they love playing with narrative and voice, Joan Didion too. So commentary is sort of a major thrust for them. But for me, the thing that gets me started writing and keeps me writing is something that I can research and something that can take me through a wormhole that reveals new information that I wasn't even looking for in the first place. I often tell my students that nonfiction is magic, and I think they think I'm just being like a weird Stevie Nicks professor, but I can count. I think I might need at least both hands and at least one of my feet to be able to count all the times where that has really proven true. When I'll start a project not knowing something that is out there already and that seems perfect once the essay is finished.
You know, on its surface, this is a book about animals, but underneath that, I think it really is about humans and the way that we interact in beautiful and also horrifying and sometimes interesting ways with animals. And so that really stuck out to me in an essay about Lancelot, who was a goat that was surgically modified to grow a single unicorn horn.
Yep.
And that one is the most personal about, it's about your personal experience with animals. And at the end of it, you say, there's a distinct possibility that every time I write about an animal, I'm only writing about him, Lancelot the goat, which might also mean horrifyingly that I'm only writing about myself. So why is that a horrifying prospect for you, especially as someone who is an essayist?
That's the very last essay that I wrote in the book. And the reason that I wrote it is kind of exactly why you said, Chris, like a lot of these stories are not really stories about the animals themselves, but about the people who are surrounding the animals. And often the animal ends up compromised to the point where it's not really a great representative of the species. It's a better representative of what's happening with humans. And I was like, well, if I'm going to be doing this for centuries worth of people who have interacted with animals, it doesn't make sense for me not to implicate myself in this. And so I tried to think of the animal that had my imagination, and it was this circus goat that was going around with Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey when I was a kid in the mid-80s that tons of people saw. And it just seems so fitting because he's not real, but he is real. He's being used to evoke wonder and mirth and happiness. My grandparents, who I adore, took me to see him. But it's also this kind of strange sense of wrongness about it, you know? Maybe, and I think maybe I even knew that back then. And that kind of creepy, queasy feeling is very much the way that I see my relationship with all animals at this point as a 21st century human who still eats meat and isn't Jane Goodall or anything. So then since I wrote this last one, I look back at all the essays in the book, I was like, oh no, this is all about that queasiness. I've just been writing a weird memoir that instead of thinking, I just went to the library a lot. But so I think I was legitimately horrified when I came to that question.
So I don't think I can let you off the hook without also talking about the fact that in addition to your writing and teaching, you are now a radio personality as the announcer on Livewire with Luke Burbank, which airs on this station. So how did you get involved with that program and what's it like being part of Livewire?
Well, this time last year, about November of 2017, I was at the Portland Book Festival and they were just bringing in people to come talk on Livewire. And it was me and Adam Gopnik. So I went on and I did the interview with Luke, and I thought it went pretty good. And then I watched him interview Gopnik, and it's really something. If you've never been to a taping of Livewire in either Seattle or Portland, he's an amazing interviewer. And my partner David was like, God, this guy's good. And I was just like, wow, I'm so glad I got to enjoy that. And then I got a phone call, and they were like, you want to come, like, be the Ed McMahon, you know, sort of like announce things and laugh at jokes and ask questions. And I just jumped at the chance, because not only am I meeting writers, comedians, musicians, there's just enough performance in it to scratch the old performance itch from my 10 years as an actor. So I'm having a really, really good time. And God bless your station for carrying it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been the real highlight of my year to join that team. Radio forever.
Yeah. Well, my guest has been Elena Passarello, who is the author of Animals Strike Curious Poses and Let Me Clear My Throat. And she's also the announcer on Livewire with Luke Burbank from Oregon Public Broadcasting. Elena, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.